2-2 pitch. Swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another Baseball America podcast. I'm Kyle Glazer, here to break down the Arizona Diamondbacks system today. And to help me, we're joined by Nick Pecoro, the Diamondbacks beat writer for the Arizona Republic and a fellow Arizona State alum. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
The Diamondbacks are one of the more interesting teams, at least to me, in the major leagues right now. They had their third straight winning season last year, contended surprisingly for a lot of people after trading Paul Goldschmidt before the year, as well as Zach Greinke during the year. They are kind of straddling a really interesting line where they are both winning games at the major league level and building up there, but they're also building up the farm system. They had a bevy of first-day picks last year. They've already used one of those in a key trade this offseason. We saw them go out and sign Madison Bumgarner. This week, they traded for Starling Marte. They also signed Cole Calhoun, which I thought was a nice under-the-radar signing this offseason as well. So they're building up while also enhancing their farm system. A lot of teams kind of have to choose one or the other. When you look at the Diamondbacks right now and just what Mike Hazen is building and how they seem to be improving in both areas, how do you kind of assess where they are as a franchise right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think you gave a pretty good synopsis there. I mean, they're kind of toeing that line. In 2017, they wound up making the postseason, getting a wild card, winning the wild card game. And that's so far been the only time they've actually been able to cash it in under Hazen's watch to actually reaching the playoffs. You're right, they've played meaningful games into September each of the previous 2 years, which certainly last year was probably more than most people expected. And as we've seen, I mean, when Hazen took over, it was probably a bottom five farm system in baseball. It's quickly moving into the, you know, probably the upper third at least, higher for some people. You mentioned the trade for Starling Marte, giving up a couple of prospects there. They made a deal at the deadline in July where they traded Jazz Chisholm for another prospect-ish type player in Zach Gallen, who had technically already reached the majors, but I probably was still qualifying as a rookie at the time. So you've seen him dip into his prospect inventory a little bit now to make moves that are helping the big league roster. And I think we're just going to have to see how this pays off over the next few years, whether they end up regretting moving any of those guys, whether those moves that they've made, allow them to reach the playoffs again before we're able to kind of really assess, how good of a job they've done.
One of the things that's jumped out to me about the moves Mike Hazen has made and what has allowed them to toe this line is a lot of the trades he's made, he's acquired upper-level prospects or young big leaguers as opposed to guys who are super far away. The Paul Goldschmidt trade, getting Luke Weaver, who was in the majors but still young and had some room to grow. Carson Kelly, who had received a taste of the majors. Andy Young, who was in the upper levels in the minors. The Zach Greinke trade even, getting Corbin Martin, who had touched the majors. Getting Seth Beer, who had already advanced to Double-A. I think he's done a really nice job of not gambling so much on these super far away, overly young guys in trades who in reality have a very low hit rate. He's getting guys who are talented players who can help the major league team within 1 or 2 years, then using the draft and the international signings to kind of backfill the back end of the farm system. And to me, all of a sudden, you have this really balanced organization of young top-level talent as well as talent throughout the system.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's kind of a matter of making small bets with each decision, right? I think that when you're talking about acquiring guys that have already reached the majors, there's just less risk involved. There's no guarantees, of course, that Carson Kelly or Luke Weaver were going to, be successful big leaguers. But there's certainly a better chance that they are than guys that are less accomplished further down. I think, too, when you look at the Zach Gallen for Jazz Chisholm trade, it's another example of getting a guy who's already in the big leagues, already shown he can have some success in the big leagues, and trading away a guy who's has a lot of questions about him. Now, look, Jazz Chisholm could become a superstar. I don't think there are anybody that would question the tools and the athleticism and just the potential for that. But the odds of it happening maybe aren't as good. I think you even saw it a little bit in that trade with the Pirates. You're obviously getting the point of that trade is to acquire a piece for now, But the guys that they traded away, look, Leover Peguero has real upside, and there's a lot of people that were very high on him, and people that thought that, you know, we had him a little low on our top 10. Other organizations that liked him even better than Perdomo. That, I don't know that that's necessarily the consensus opinion, but people really like Peguero. But, you know, we're talking about a lower-level infielder that likes to swing. And that's a risky, you know, type of demographic. Even riskier demographic is Brendan Malone, the high school right-hander. So, I mean, I think that they've made a lot of decisions where they've kind of said, like, look, let's just kind of play the percentages a little bit here. And let's look, we're not going to go get players we don't like. But, you know, if it's a choice between, you know, the more advanced, the safer demographic, I think they're gonna lean that way every time.
And I think one of the things, too, a lot of people say it's either upside or risk. And in reality, we've seen the Diamondbacks get guys who have both. Again, Carson Kelly, a top 100 prospect for a number of years, potential all-star catcher. He showed some promise in his debut last year. There's plenty of upside there as well as limited risk. You know, Luke Weaver, again, was a first-round pick, top 100 prospect, needed some development. But again, it's not like these guys are bit players. These are all guys who had pedigree, who have shown what they can do at the upper levels. Zach Gallen, again, was a third-round pick who had climbed into the top 100 with the Marlins last year before they acquired him in the trade. So it seems like they've done a nice job acquiring legitimate upside without enormous risk. As a result, the Diamondbacks were in a good place. I do want to start with this farm system. There's an interesting debate at the top with Dalton Varsho at number one. You also have guys like Geraldo Perdomo and Christian Robinson and Alec Thomas, who was their number one prospect at midseason last year. It's a really interesting group of guys who are all good. They're all in the top 100, but none of them are in the top 50. How did you kind of sort this group out? Again, they're all very good, but they're all pretty close as well.
Yeah, it was tough, especially when you start looking at tools and you start grading things out, particularly when it comes to Christian Robinson and wondering just what the future upside could be there and trying to weigh that against, you know, just how unproven he is. I think that it just came down with Varsho for me, in that this is a guy that plays a premium position. I know that there still seems to be some questions about how much he's going to catch or just how well he's going to catch. The people I spoke to, look, internally, they're pretty confident. And I talked to, I don't know, a half dozen scouts with other clubs that didn't see any reason to think that this guy couldn't catch at the big league level. And then you combine that with the fact that, you know, he's a premium athlete. He's hit at every level. I think if you take away, I think he has a three. I'll bring it up right now. I'm pretty sure he has a 300 career batting average and an OPS of 879 in three minor league seasons. And I think that if you were to take away the 2 weeks that he struggled when he came back from a hamate surgery in the middle of the 2018 season, he came back real fast. You'd be probably looking at an OPS closer to 900 in his career. And last year he was in a really difficult Double-A environment in the Southern League. It's never an easy place to hit, and posted an OPS of 900, the highest in the Southern League. It was just a combination of, like, look, this is a really good athlete. He's performed at high levels. He plays a premium position. And then you look at the fact that they ran him out in center field a little bit at the end of the year. He played pretty much primarily there in the postseason in Double-A. And there's, you know, some talk of, you know, if need be, could this guy play second base? Like, it just feels like there's a lot of different ways that this guy can impact the team. And you know, one of those guys that I would be surprised, kind of the way that you looked up and you saw, you know, what, 6-7 years ago, you'd look up and Ben Zobrist would have like a 6 or 8 WAR season. You'd be kind of like, how did he do that? And you kind of dig a little deeper and you understand, like, Varsho kind of seems like that kind of potential. Under him, I mean, it was difficult kind of coming up with how you're going to order the next ones. With Perdomo, I think it was a lot of the same things, in that it's a premium defender, or you know, a defender at a premium position. Pretty much no questions about whether he's going to be able to play shortstop. And then a guy that, you know, walks as much as he strikes out, carries OPSs, OBPs in the 400 range, started to show a little bit more ability to drive the ball as the season went on, particularly in the fall league. Started hearing from scouts that saw him that were like, I didn't know that was in there. You know, they kind of start to dream on a guy developing, you know, double digit home run type power based on looks that they get off of him. And it starts to kind of add up that this is a guy who's pretty advanced, you know, and has all those other things. That's kind of why I've had him there. But I mean, I will say, like, when, like I said, when you start looking at the tools for Christian Robinson, it gives you some second thoughts. But I think I just kept reminding myself that we've seen so many toolsy outfielders over the years that can kind of, you know, do some real damage against the lower levels and then hit speed bumps when they get to the, you know, to the middle of the minor league ladder. And Robinson hasn't got there yet, and we just haven't seen it yet. So I'm not, certainly not saying that he couldn't be I wouldn't be surprised if we're looking at a top 10 prospect in the game this time a year from now. But he just hasn't done it yet, and that was kind of the same thing that held me back with being too aggressive with Corbin Carroll.
Yeah, I want to go back to Varsho. I actually really like that Ben Zobrist comparison you dropped. To me, it feels like this is someone who is being underrated. Again, you mentioned it. He played at AA Jackson, which is one of the most pitcher-friendly environments in the Southern League. Led the Southern League at OPS while going nearly 20-20 as a catcher. And then, oh, by the way, bouncing out to center field, left-handed hitter, all the intangibles are there. Dad was a big leaguer. There's all these boxes being checked, and yet he just doesn't seem to get the love that a lot of other prospects get. I think part of it, he's not this big physical monster people see on the field and go, wow. But more often than not, he's the best player on the field. And to me, I think that says a lot when you watch the game and say, hey, this guy's doing everything you could ask him to do, and he's doing it better than almost anyone on the field. That counts for something.
I didn't mention the speed when I was breaking him down, but you're right, that's a huge aspect. And but I guess the one thing that he doesn't do that you'd probably have an easier time getting really excited about him is he doesn't throw. I think it's a below average arm. He does have quick release, accurate arm. It seems like he's able to kind of offset the lack of arm strength with good footwork, good exchange, good throwing accuracy. But, you know, that's a thing that traditionally when you're grading out catchers, when scouts are evaluating them, the arm strength is a big factor. And that is the one thing that he doesn't have. Perhaps that, you know, if his arm had, you know, two more grades to it, people would be talking about him a little bit differently. But even still, I mean, I guess the other thing is too, it's a small kind of, and I don't want to say like a pudgy body or anything, but he's not like chiseled. He doesn't have that physique. Maybe that's another reason why people don't get as excited. But like you said, I mean, the performance, the athleticism, the position. To me, you kind of have to come back to that when you're ranking them.
No question about it. And as we mentioned, Perdomo really opened some eyes toward the end of the year. I got to see him in Visalia at the end of the year, and I remember just talking to their coaching staff. And, you know, at the time, a lot of people were talking about Alec Thomas, and they kept saying, look, Thomas is really good. Perdomo's the guy. And it really was coming out for everyone to see in the fall league. And, you know, as you mentioned with Robinson, this is such a potential monster. But as you said, there's something to be said for showing what you can do against better pitching. I did want to dive in on that a little bit. How much faith is there that he will be able to connect against better pitching? He finished last year at low Class A Kane County. What's the confidence level evaluators have that he will hit enough against better full season pitching?
Well, I mean, you start to break down some of the pitch data and swing data information on him, and it does give you a little bit more hope. He really doesn't chase that much. He doesn't swing and miss a ton on pitches in the zone. It sort of seems like he's already starting to do a lot of the things that he needs to do. He didn't look great, and I heard that from a handful of people when he did reach the Midwest League late last season. And those are, I don't know, I mean, I think we're all probably guilty of just putting a little bit too much you know, the recency bias type of thing, putting a little bit too much stock in, you know, small sample sizes, but at higher levels, and it just gives you a little bit of pause. I mean, I think that it's sort of similar with Alec Thomas. Like, this was a guy that torched the Midwest League and got promoted to the Cal League and didn't hit that well for 30-something games. Had he just stayed in the Midwest League and finished his year with those numbers, would I have been more inclined to put him even higher on the list? Maybe. I mean, I think if you would have asked me at some point in July who's the number one prospect in the system, I think Varsho had a really strong finish and wound up leading the Southern League in like we talked about in OPS, and coupled with Thomas falling off a little bit, you know, that sort of stuff, it's hard not to be influenced by that to some degree. So I don't know. I guess, you know, going back to what you're saying about Robinson, I think a lot of people are really excited. I think a lot of people believe that it's going to come together. I think so too, that people are also trying to be cautiously optimistic because it's a guy that's, you know, comes from the Bahamas, doesn't come from a place where he's faced a ton of high level competition, you know, starting at, you know, age 12. You know, it's a lot of stuff that's new for him. And I think people are kind of building in a little bit of a buffer there, kind of building in, you know, some just trying to keep people's expectations in line. But look, it could come fast, but it also might take a little while, so we'll just have to wait and see.
He was 18 all of last year, as you mentioned, had that 25 game stint in the Midwest League as a very, very young player. I do think this year will be, you know, more indicative, okay, this is where he's at, because you're right, he hasn't faced a lot of the high level competition, and in some ways I believe this offseason will be really, really key for him. Alec Thomas and Corbin Carroll at number 4 and 5 have some similarities. They're both smaller center fielders. Very, very interesting field to hit that you can project on. How did you stack these two up, and what were the overall evaluations of these two, especially Carroll after kind of a gangbusters debut?
Really, really similar. I mean, it felt like every time you started breaking down both guys' tools, they were really right in line with each other. I think I just sort of erred on the side of being conservative when it comes to Corbin Carroll, just because he hasn't done it yet, but I could see myself moving, you know, both the hit and the power grades up based on performance this year. And, you know, I mentioned this, I think, during the chat. I had a chance to watch him take batting practice after he signed at Chase Field. And it was pretty impressive. I don't think I've seen a high school draftee look like he belongs in the big league hitting group as much as Corbin Carroll did that day. I will say, you know, like, he did have the benefit of hitting the big league balls last year, right? I mean, so those maybe traveled a little bit more than balls would have in the past, but this guy was hitting balls out over the overhang just to the right of center field. He's hitting balls over the pool area. I mean, he was blasting balls out. And, you know, it is a bit of an undersized guy, but there's clearly raw power there. And that's not even the thing that people talk the most about with him. They talk about just watching him play and the feel he has for the game. Just the maturity he has on the bases, the maturity he has in his approach at the plate. Just a guy that knows how to play the game, and, you know, just for his age too, it's just that much more impressive. So I think they're really similar players. I'm really curious to see how the two of them develop over the years and how they kind of separate themselves. But you know, if you're looking at them right now, it's hard to, for me at least, it's hard to really like be too aggressive in putting one over the other.
And there is something to be said for the fact Thomas has done what Carroll hopes to do this year already. Went up, hit very, very well in the Midwest League, got to high Class A in his first full season as a 19-year-old. But Carroll's very talented. I know a lot of people felt the Diamondbacks got a steal getting him at the 16th overall pick. For a lot of the lead-up to the draft, a lot of people I talked to considered him a top 10 type talent. I know the Diamondbacks were very, very happy and a little bit surprised to get him at 16. So there's definitely a chance that when we look back a couple years from now, they're going to have come away with a steal. The top five players on this list, I think, were the five names that were fairly consensus. Some people might have had different order, but it seemed like these were the top five that you expected to be the top five when the list came out. Number six, Blake Walston, was a little bit of the surprise and very interesting his progression after signing. The Diamondbacks took him with one of their seven first-day picks last year, 26th overall, out of a high school in Wilmington, North Carolina. It was higher than a lot of people had Walston. He himself was surprised that he got drafted that high. And immediately in his first pro summer, he went out, showed better stuff than was expected, added some strength, and all of a sudden finds himself number six in a very, very good system. What were some of the things you were hearing about Walston, and what gave you the confidence after speaking with evaluators to run him up the list this high?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of touched on it. Just the fact that the stuff seems to quickly improve. I mean, I think that, you know, that these guys believed that it was in there. I think they were really pleasantly surprised to see it come out that quickly. You know, I think they maybe thought that he would start to show some of the things that he showed last summer, maybe this year. But instead, he comes right out of the draft, and I think he put on 25 pounds or so. I think he's still looking to add a little bit more weight. But, you know, this is a guy that can be a, you know, big left-handed workhorse, and, you know, who could have a fastball that sits in the you know, low to mid-90s and touches more than that. A guy with potentially a wipeout breaking ball, and it's kind of more of a slurvy pitch at the moment, but they describe it more slidery than curveball. And a guy who, you know, could potentially, you know, separate those two pitches with a curveball and a slider, has a changeup as well. I mean, there's a lot to like, and it's just you just start, I don't know, you talk to enough people, and you talk to enough people long enough about players, and you just kind of start to read how they really feel about guys. And the excitement level with this pitcher is as high as I've heard from this group of D-backs, you know, officials and coaches in the system for a long time for a pitcher. They just seem to think that this guy has, you know, really like number two starter type potential.
The rest of this list included Leover Peguero and Brendan Malone, the two prospects traded for Starling Marte. You also had Corbin Martin and Luis Frias, two pitchers who are risky for different reasons. Martin, coming off Tommy John surgery, he was acquired in the deal that sent Zach Greinke to the Astros. Frias has big stuff, but he's also a 21-year-old who has only been in low A. What elevated these guys into the top 10 over some other guys like maybe a Seth Beer or a John Duplantier, JB Pukauskas, who are kind of big names who've done it at higher levels, or a guy like a Levi Kelly, who is a really promising right-hander who just had a really good year and is healthy? What kept these two, the two that rounded out the top 10 over those guys?
I think probably just a few more warts on some of the other guys. Levi Kelly was harder to drop down, but you hear more and more people that are pretty convinced it's a reliever in the long run. That was hard for me to do because I've found myself reluctant to bet too much on that sort of stuff. I guess I've just seen enough, you know, people look at Chris Sale's delivery or Max Scherzer's delivery and say, oh, that's not going to work as a starter, and then you look up and they win Cy Young. So I'm a little bit hesitant to do that, but I did end up kind of buying into it in that there's maybe not a well-developed third pitch as well, and just the question of whether it's going to be able to hold up over a full season. We haven't seen him, you know, log 175, 180, 200 innings before. With Duplantier, it's just the stuff is just—it's so inconsistent. He didn't look like anything close to even a mid-rotation starter for stretches at the big league level last year. In his defense, he was, you know, kind of jerked around, going between the rotation and the bullpen, and he never really got built up and stretched out the way that you'd like to see. Some of that is on him. I don't think he performed very well at times, including in Reno. But, you know, a lot of it is on the fact that there was need at the big league level, and they were going to him at multiple times. He did suffer another injury. You know, with his history, that's scary. I think you also mentioned Seth Beer, and it's just there's a lot of pressure on the bat, and a lot of evaluators who I spoke to are not convinced that it's an elite type of bat, that it's more of an above average bat, and if it's going to be a DH only or a well below average defender, you know, just how valuable is that? We'll have to see. The performance in the minor leagues so far has been tremendous. You know, there's always that to fall back on, but you know, he's going to have to keep doing it. He's going to have to keep doing it at a really, really high level, because people don't think it's, you know, that a corner outfield is an option. There's people that don't know that first base is even an option. And if it's more of a, you know, I'm trying to think of some of the names that people were dropping as a, you know, like an Alan Craig type of hitter. Obviously, you know, very different profiles. I'm just kind of talking about the overall production. An overall type of first base production like that isn't super valuable. Not that he's, you know, Alan Craig at his peak was a bad player, but it's not a guy you get super excited about and that runs up prospect lists when you're a first baseman. And the other guys, I think there's just more belief in the system with Luis Frias, that this is a guy that can stick as a starting pitcher. He's got the wipeout breaking ball. He's got, you know, stuff that's he's able to hold deep into games. He's a real physical guy that you can kind of envision, you know, turning into that big mid rotation type of guy that's going to eat you a lot of innings. And with that breaking ball, there's some swing and miss potential, and obviously a fastball that you know reaches the mid to upper 90s. Not as familiar with Corbin Martin, of course, you know, because he was acquired from a different organization, and I don't know his progression as well up the ladder, but I mean, it was a guy that, you know, I know the Diamondbacks were talking about Corbin Martin when they were discussing Goldschmidt with the Astros, and at that time they were told no. You know, when the injury occurred, I think that changed the thinking for the Astros and kind of made him available all of a sudden. And the Diamondbacks kind of pounced on it. I think they see a guy, you know, like we talked about earlier, a guy who's like Luke Weaver, and that he's already reached the majors. There's still a huge ceiling there. They think that this is a guy that could be a mid-rotation starter or better. You know, a legitimate four-pitch mix, pretty good strike thrower, you know, good velocity, good athlete. So yeah, there's a lot to like there, and he's performed at just about every level. He struggled a little bit during his time in the majors. It was very, very abbreviated, obviously. But yeah, I mean, and you did hit on it, that there is some risk there. There's always some risk when a guy's coming back from surgery. We'll just have to see how he develops. The other arm in that deal, Bukauskas, I guess I just got too many people that were convinced it was a reliever. Even if it's dominant stuff, it's hard to run a reliever too high up the list. And I mean, obviously the performance was really, really bad last year, and he finished the year with an elbow issue. So kind of all of those things were red flags for me.
The guy I want to dive in on a little bit is Seth Beer. And the reason is because a lot of the things that scouts are saying about him, you know, bad athlete, he's got a lot of power, I don't know how good of a hitter he is, it's first base only, how much value are you going to get, are the exact same things scouts were saying at this time last year about Pete Alonso and Yordan Alvarez. And at the end of the day, if you can thump, you can thump. And if you can thump, you're going to be in the middle of the big league order, providing more value than a lot of the other up-the-middle toolsy guys who can't hit like you can. One of the things that stood out to me about Beer, I saw him after he was drafted in 2018 at Buies Creek, and it was a thick lower half. I understood the concerns and whether or not this was going to develop into someone who can really hit at the major league level and have the twitch needed to do it. I saw him this year in the fall league. He had slimmed down a lot. He was in much better shape, and we saw the performance. He got to Double-A this year and hit well. In the fall league, he was very, very impressive. This is an interesting guy. Do you feel like there's a chance evaluators are too light on him because they're focusing on the profile and not the talent? Because we have seen that a lot in the past with these first base DH only types.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was exactly what I was going to say as you were getting to it, is that I think that it's just always easier for these evaluators to play the percentages on these things. I mean, that's kind of what they're paid to do, right? And most of the time, if they you know, have some of the attributes that Beer has, it's not always, it's most of the time not going to come together in an elite fashion, right? So I think that's probably what they're doing here. It's just like, I think that the biggest thing that I kept hearing was just how real is the power. Is it just a little bit above average, or is it truly plus? Like, I was going back and reading some reports, you know, describing it as easy double plus, or, you know, easy plus, you know, and I just didn't hear that. And I didn't get enough people corroborating that belief that, you know, there's like a 35 home run bat or 35 home run season in there at any time. Look, people have been wrong on guys all the time. I was wondering if you were going to say people were saying the same things 10 years ago about Paul Goldschmidt, because they were. And that, you know, that alone, that experience alone has taught me to be a little bit wary of the evaluators, particularly when you're looking at a guy that's performed every step of the way. So I don't know. We'll see. I think my biggest concern is probably the position, and the value he'll be able to bring on that side of the ball. You mentioned that Alonso improved. Goldschmidt was not the smoothest looking, and raised a lot of questions in people's eyes a decade ago when they saw him in Visalia, and went on to win Gold Gloves. So there's obviously the potential for guys to improve. And while Seth Beer doesn't look like a great athlete, we should keep in mind this was a guy who was on an Olympic path as a swimmer before giving it up, I think, at age 12 or 13. So there is some athleticism, obviously, in there. Whether he can, you know, use it to get himself, you know, up to a better level defensively remains to be seen.
Yeah, I think this is going to be one of the more interesting guys to watch in the system this year, and we'll see if he can start tapping into even more power. He hit 24 home runs last year, and when you compare him to some of the guys we talked about, you know, Goldschmidt, his 2 years in the minors, he hit 35 and 30. Alonso hit 36, tying for the minor league lead in homers. We'll see how much power is in there, but I do think that Seth Beer is one of the more interesting guys in this system. Nick, just to wrap up, this is a very deep system. That's what really stands out and partially what makes this system now definitely one of the top half in baseball. You'll be able to see exactly where they rank once we release our organization talent rankings here in the coming weeks. How difficult was it to kind of sort out all the guys for who's going to be at the back of this list? Because it seems like we had 30 spots, and sometimes you do this list, even for the Diamondbacks, and it's a stretch to even find 25 worthy guys, let alone 30. It feels like this year you had a lot more to work with, 40, 50 names even.
Right. No, I agree. I think that's absolutely the case. I think this was my third year doing it. The first year I did it, there was a lot of relief types, like no doubt relievers on the list, showing up all over. This year, you know, Bukauskas is the only guy that I think actually I had Bukauskas and Kevin Ginkle on the list. And look, there's pitchers on the, you know, near the back end, or really, I guess even in the middle, where there's probably some reliever risk, even Duplantier in some people's minds. But really there are only a couple of guys that the overwhelming consensus is that we're going to be relievers this time. You kind of start looking at the guys that you left off, and there's some really interesting players that I think that were the system not as deep, or were I doing it today, you know, following the trades of Peguero and Malone, guys that would suddenly show up on the list. I think Yosmer Alvarez did not crack the top 30. That's a really interesting young pitcher. There's an outfielder named Jefferson Espinal, another young international guy, Diomed Sierra, a left-handed pitcher. Alvin Guzman was their big dollar guy a couple of years ago. Their big dollar international guy from last year, Franiel Baez, didn't make the list. So I don't know. There's just a lot of players there's also a lot of players that I think are going to be big leaguers in some fashion. You know, like a Matt Peacock or Emilio Vargas or Jake McCarthy or Tyler Holton, who didn't make the list. So yeah, it was difficult. I guess that's a problem you'd rather have than the alternative. I think we're all I don't know. I think if you're optimistic about players, and try to look on the bright side, and you find yourself saying every year that, like, oh man, yeah, this is a more interesting list than it was, because a year ago you can now look back, or a year later, I mean, you can now look back and see the list in a much different light. So you're always I think going to be a little bit more optimistic in the present. But I do think it's probably more true now than it has been in the past. It's just, it's a much more interesting system. It's a much deeper system. There's a lot more upside in this system.
So the big question is, given the young talent they have in the major leagues, given the newfound depth of this system, what's the ETA, the realistic ETA for this team to start potentially contending with the Dodgers? Also, the Dodgers won 7 straight division titles. They have a tremendous farm system. They also have an incredible base of young talent in the major leagues. Really, how likely is it that the Diamondbacks can potentially start running them down and competing with them at the top of the division? And when do you think that would be, given all the pieces they have in place right now?
I don't think anybody can reasonably put any kind of date on that. I just think, like, I'm not saying it wouldn't change in a couple of years, but I think as far out as you can possibly, you know, anticipate that sort of thing is probably 3 years. What I mean is the farthest out you can anticipate how a roster is going to look and contend within a division is 3 years, regardless of what teams we're talking about. And if you go 3 years out right now, I don't think anybody would ever would say they'd take the Diamondbacks over the Dodgers. So, look, in a few years, maybe that changes. But, you know, like you said, they have a lot of really good young talent at the big league level. They still have a really good farm system. They have seemingly very good processes in place. They have the capability for an enormous payroll, which allows them to not only, you know, keep the players that they develop, but also go out and they haven't really done this yet, but go out and add a superstar if they wanted. So it's just, I don't think that I can reasonably say there's any date on the horizon that could happen. I'm not saying it never will. I wouldn't be comfortable predicting it.
I think that's definitely the right way to go. But the Diamondbacks, again, they've put themselves in a good position, and we'll see what they can do. They've loaded up, as we mentioned, adding Madison Bumgarner, adding Starling Marte, adding Cole Calhoun, and especially in the case of Marte, adding an impact everyday center fielder without significantly altering the outlook for the future in terms of trading away top guys. They traded good players, and they have many more to fill those spots, which is testament to the system they've built, and now we'll see how it all translates in the major leagues. Nick, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your insight as always.
Hey, my pleasure, Kyle. See you next time.
All right, everyone. That'll do it for this edition of the Baseball America podcast. Go ahead and give us a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitch, or whatever platform you're listening on. We'd love to hear from you. For Nick Pecoro, I'm Kyle Glazer. Thanks for listening, everybody.